This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The House of the Spirits, a novel, by Isabel Allende. Read by Marisol Ramirez and Tom Rivera. How much does a man live after all? Does he live 1,000 days? Or one only? For a week? Or for several centuries? How long does a man spend dying? What does it mean to say forever? Pablo Neruda.
1. Rosa, the beautiful. Barrabás came to us by sea. The child Clara wrote in her delicate calligraphy. She was already in the habit of writing down important matters, and afterward, when she was mute, she also recorded trivialities, never suspecting that 50 years later I would use her notebooks to reclaim the past and overcome terrors of my own. Barrabás arrived on a Holy Thursday. He was in a despicable cage, caked with his own excrement and urine, and had the lost look of a hapless, utterly defenseless prisoner. But the regal carriage of his head and the size of his frame bespoke the legendary giant he would become. It was a bland autumnal day that gave no hint of the events that the child would record, which took place during the noon mass in the parish of San Sebastian, with her whole family in attendance. As a sign of mourning, the statues of the saints were shrouded in purple robes that the pious ladies of the congregation unpacked and dusted off once a year from the cupboard in the sacristy. Beneath these funereal sheets, the celestial retinue resembled nothing so much as a room full of furniture awaiting movers, an impression that the candles, the incense, and the soft moans of the organ were powerless to counteract. Terrifying dark bundles loomed where the life-size saints had stood, each with its influenza-pale expression, its elaborate wig woven from the hair of someone long dead, its rubies, pearls, and emeralds of painted glass, and the rich gown of a Florentine aristocrat. The only one whose appearance was enhanced by mourning was the church's patron saint, Sebastian. For during Holy Week, the faithful were spared the sight of that body, twisted in the most indecent posture, pierced by arrows, and dripping with blood and tears like a suffering homosexual, whose wounds, kept miraculously fresh by Father Restrepo's brush, made Clara tremble with disgust. It was a long week of penitence and fasting, during which there were no card games and no music that might lead to lust or abandon. And within the limits of possibility, the strictest sadness and chastity were observed, even though it was precisely at this time that the forked tail of the devil pricked most insistently at Catholic flesh. The fast consisted of soft puff pastries, delicious vegetarian dishes, spongy tortillas, and enormous cheeses from the countryside, with which each family commemorated the Passion of the Lord, taking every precaution not to touch the least morsel of meat or fish on pain of excommunication, as Father Restrepo had repeatedly made clear. No one had ever dared to disobey him. The priest was blessed with a long, incriminating finger, which he used to point out sinners in public, and a tongue well-schooled in arousing emotions. "There's the thief, who steals from the collection box," he shouted from the pulpit, as he pointed to a gentleman who was busying himself with the lint on his lapel so as not to show his face. "And there's the shameless hussy, who prostitutes herself down by the docks." He accused Doña Esther Trueba, disabled by arthritis and a devotee of the Virgin del Carmen, who opened her eyes wide, not knowing the meaning of the word or where the docks were. "Repent, sinners, foul carrion, unworthy of our Lord's great sacrifice. Fast. Do penance. Carried away by vocational zeal, the priest did all he could do to avoid openly disobeying the instructions of his ecclesiastic superiors, who, shaken by the winds of modernism, were opposed to hair shirts and flagellation. He himself was a firm believer in the value of a good thrashing to vanquish the weaknesses of the soul, and was famous for his unrestrained oratory. The faithful followed him from parish to parish, sweating as he described the torments of the damned in hell, the bodies ripped apart by various ingenious torture apparatuses, the eternal flames, the hooks that pierced the male member, the disgusting reptiles that crept up female orifices, and the myriad other sufferings that he wove into his sermons to strike the fear of God into the hearts of his parishioners. Even Satan was described in his most intimate perversions in the Galician accents of this priest, whose mission in this world was to rouse the conscience of his indolent Creole flock. Severo del Valle was an atheist and a Mason, but he had political ambitions and could not allow himself the luxury of missing the most heavily attended Mass on Sundays and feast days, when everyone would have a chance to see him. His wife, Nivea, preferred to deal with God without benefit of intermediaries. She had a deep distrust of cassocks and was bored by descriptions of heaven, purgatory, and hell. But she shared her husband's parliamentary ambitions, hoping that if he won a seat in Congress, she would finally secure the vote for women, for which she had fought for the past 10 years, permitting none of her numerous pregnancies to get in her way. On this Holy Thursday, Father Restrepo had led his audience to the limits of their endurance with his apocalyptic visions, and Nivea was beginning to feel dizzy. She wondered if she was pregnant again. Despite cleansings with vinegar and spongings with gall, she had given birth to 15 children, of whom 11 were still alive. But she had good reason to suppose that she was settling into maturity, because her daughter Clara, the youngest of her children, was now 10. It seemed that the force of her astonishing fertility had finally begun to ebb. She was able to attribute her present discomfort to Father Restrepo when he pointed at her to illustrate a point about the Pharisees who had tried to legalize bastards in civil marriage, thereby dismembering the family, the fatherland, private property, and the church, and putting women on an equal footing with men. This in open defiance of the law of God, which was most explicit on the issue. Along with their children, Nivea and Severo took up the entire third row of benches. Clara was seated beside her mother, who squeezed her hand impatiently whenever the priest lingered too long on the sins of the flesh, for she knew that this would only lead the child to visualize with even greater accuracy aberrations that transcended reality. Clara was extremely precocious and had inherited the runaway imagination of all the women in her family on her mother's side. This was evident from the questions she asked, to which no one knew the answers. The temperature inside the church had risen, and the penetrating odor of the candles, the incense, and the tightly packed crowd all contributed to Nivea's fatigue. She wished the ceremony would end at once, so she could return to her cool house, sit down among the ferns, and taste the pitcher of barley water flavored with almonds that Nana always made on holidays. She looked around at her children. The younger ones were tired and rigid in their Sunday best, and the older ones were beginning to squirm. Her gaze rested on Rosa, the oldest of her living daughters, and, as always, she was surprised. The girl's strange beauty had a disturbing quality that even she could not help noticing, for this child of hers seemed to have been made of a different material from the rest of the human race. Even before she was born, Nivea had known she was not of this world, because she had already seen her in dreams. This was why she had not been surprised when the midwife screamed as the child emerged. At birth, Rosa was white and smooth, without a wrinkle, like a porcelain doll, with green hair and yellow eyes. The most beautiful creature to be born on Earth since the days of original sin, as the midwife put it, making the sign of the cross. From her very first bath, Nana had washed her hair with chamomile, which softened its color, giving it the hue of old bronze, and put her out in the sun with nothing on to strengthen her skin, which was translucent in the most delicate parts of her chest and armpits, where the veins and secret texture of muscles could be seen. Nana's gypsy tricks did not suffice, however, and rumors quickly spread that Nivea had borne an angel. Nivea hoped that the successive and unpleasant stages of growth would bring her daughter a few imperfections, but nothing of the sort occurred. On the contrary, at 18, Rosa was still slender and remained unblemished. Her maritime grace had, if anything, increased. The tone of her skin, with its soft, bluish lights, and of her hair, as well as her slow movements and silent character, all made one think of some inhabitant of the sea. There was something of the fish to her. If she had had a scaly tail, she would have been a mermaid. But her two legs placed her squarely on the tenuous line between a human being and a creature of myth. Despite everything, the young woman had led a nearly normal life. She had a fiancé and would one day marry, on which occasion the responsibility of her beauty would become her husband's. Rosa bowed her head, and a ray of sunlight pierced the Gothic-stained glass windows of the church, outlining her face into a halo of light. A few people turned to look at her and whispered among themselves, as often happened as she passed. But Rosa seemed oblivious. She was immune to vanity, and that day she was more absent than usual, dreaming of new beasts to embroider on her tablecloth, creatures that were half bird and half mammal, covered with iridescent feathers and endowed with horns and hooves, and so fat and with such stubby wings that they defied the laws of biology and aerodynamics. She rarely thought about her fiancé, Esteban Trueba, not because she did not love him, but because of her forgetful nature, and because 2 years' absence is a long time. He was working in the mines in the north. He wrote to her regularly, and Rosa sometimes replied, sending him lines of poetry and drawings of flowers she had copied out on sheets of parchment paper. Through this correspondence, which Nivea violated with impunity at regular intervals, she learned about the hazards of a miner's life, always dreading avalanches, pursuing elusive veins, asking for credit against good luck that was still to come, and trusting that someday he would strike a marvelous seam of gold that would allow him to become a rich man overnight and return to lead Rosa by the arm to the altar, thus becoming the happiest man in the universe, as he always wrote at the end of his letters. Rosa, however, was in no rush to marry and had all but forgotten the only kiss they had exchanged when they said goodbye, nor could she recall the color of her tenacious suitor's eyes. Because of the romantic novels that were her only reading matter, she liked to picture him in thick-soled boots, his skin tanned from the desert winds, clawing the earth in search of pirates' treasure, Spanish doubloons, and Incan jewels. It was useless for Nivea to attempt to convince her that the wealth of mines lay in rocks, because to Rosa, it was inconceivable that Esteban Trueba would spend years piling up boulders in the hope that by subjecting them to God only knew what wicked incinerating processes, they would eventually spit out a gram of gold. Meanwhile, she awaited him without boredom, unperturbed by the enormous task she had taken upon herself, to embroider the largest tablecloth in the world. She had begun with dogs, cats, and butterflies, but soon her imagination had taken over, and her needle had given birth to a whole paradise filled with impossible creatures that took shape beneath her father's worried eyes. Severo felt that it was time for his daughter to shake off her lethargy, stand firmly in reality, and learn the domestic skills that would prepare her for marriage. But Nevia thought differently. She preferred not to torment her daughter with earthly demands, for she had a premonition that her daughter was a heavenly being, and that she was not destined to last very long in the vulgar traffic of this world. For this reason, she left her alone with her embroidery threads and said nothing about Rosa's nightmarish zoology. A bone in Nevia's corset snapped, and the point jabbed her in the ribs. She felt she was choking in her blue velvet dress, with its high lace collar, its narrow sleeves, and a waist so tight that when she removed her belt, her stomach jumped and twisted for half an hour while her organs fell back in place. She had often discussed this with her suffragette friends, and they had all agreed that until women shortened their dresses and their hair and stopped wearing corsets, it made no difference if they studied medicine or had the right to vote, because they would not have the strength to do it. But she herself was not brave enough to be among the first to give up the fashion. She noticed that the voice from Galicia had ceased hammering at her brain. They were in one of those long breaks in the sermon that the priest, a connoisseur of unbearable silences, used with frequency and to great effect. His burning eyes glanced over the parishioners one by one. Nevia dropped Clara's hand and pulled a handkerchief from her sleeve to blot the drop of sweat that was rolling down her neck. The silence grew thick, and time seemed to stop within the church, but no one dared to cough or shift position so as not to attract Father Restrepo's attention. His final sentences were still ringing between the columns. Just at that moment, as Nevia would recall years later, in the midst of all that anxiety and silence, the voice of little Clara was heard in all its purity. "Psst! Father Restrepo, if that story about hell is a lie, we're all fucked, aren't we?" The Jesuit's index finger, which was already raised to illustrate additional tortures, remained suspended like a lightning rod above his head. People stopped breathing, and those whose heads had been nodding suddenly woke up. Señor and Señora del Valle were the first to react. They were swept by panic as they saw their children fidget nervously. Severo understood that he must act before collective laughter broke out around them, or some divine cataclysm occurred. He grabbed his wife by the arm and Clara by the neck, and walked out dragging them behind him with enormous strides, followed by his other children, who stampeded toward the door. They managed to escape before the priest could summon a ray of lightning to turn them all into pillars of salt, but from the threshold they could hear his dreadful voice of offended archangel. "Possessed! She's possessed by the devil!" These words of Father Restrepo were etched in the family memory with all the gravity of a diagnosis, and in the years to come, they had more than one occasion to recall them. The only one who never thought of them again was Clara herself, who simply wrote them in her diary and forgot them. Her parents, however, could not forget, even though they both agreed that demonic possession was a sin too great for such a tiny child. They were afraid of other people's curses and Father Restrepo's fanaticism. Until that day, they had never given a name to the eccentricities of their youngest daughter, nor had it ever crossed their minds to ascribe them to satanic influence. Clara's strangeness was simply an attribute of their youngest daughter, like Luisa's limp or Rosa's beauty. The child's mental powers bothered no one and produced no great disorder. They almost always surfaced in matters of minor importance and within the strict confines of their home. It was true there had been times, just as they were about to sit down to dinner and everyone was in the large dining room, seated according to dignity and position, when the salt cellar would suddenly begin to shake and move among the plates and goblets without any visible source of energy or sign of illusionist trick. Nevia would pull Clara's braids, and that would be enough to wake her daughter from her mad distraction and return the salt cellar to immobility. The other children had organized a system so that in case of visitors, whoever was closest would reach out and stop whatever might be moving on the table before the guests noticed and were startled. The family continued eating without comment. They had also grown accustomed to the youngest daughter's prophecies. She would announce earthquakes in advance, which was quite useful in that country of catastrophes, for it gave them a chance to lock up the good dishes and place their slippers within reach in case they had to run out in the middle of the night. At the age of 6, Clara had foreseen that the horse was going to throw Luis, but he refused to listen, and had had a dislocated hip ever since. In time, his left leg had shortened, and he had to wear a special shoe with an enormous platform that he made himself. After that, Nevia had worried, but Nana reassured her by telling her that many children fly like birds, guess other people's dreams, and speak with ghosts, but that they all outgrow it when they lose their innocence. None of them reach adulthood like that, she explained. Wait till she starts to demonstrate. You'll see how fast she loses interest in making furniture move across the room and predicting disasters. Clara was Nana's pet. She had helped her at birth and was the only one who really understood the child's eccentricities. When Clara had emerged from her mother's womb, Nana had cradled and washed her, and from that time on, she had felt a desperate love for this fragile creature, whose lungs were always full of phlegm, who was always on the verge of losing her breath and turning purple, and whom she had had to revive so many times with the warmth of her huge breasts because she knew that this was the only cure for asthma, much more effective than Dr. Cuevas's fortified syrups. On that particular Holy Thursday, Severo was pacing up and down the drawing room, worrying about the scandal his daughter had provoked at Mass. He reasoned that only a fanatic like Father Restrepo could believe in satanic possession in the heart of the 20th century. This century of light, science, and technology, a time in which the devil had finally lost his reputation. Nevia interrupted him to say that was not the point. The seriousness of what had happened was that if word of their daughter's powers reached beyond the walls of the house and the priest began his own investigation, all their neighbors would find out. People are going to start lining up to look at her as if she were a monster, Nevia said. And the Liberal Party will go to hell, Severo added, anticipating the damage to his political career that could be caused by having a bewitched child in the family. Just then, Nana shuffled in with her sandals flapping, in her frou-frou of starchy petticoats, to announce that a group of men were out in the courtyard unloading a dead man. And so they were. A four-horse carriage had drawn up outside, occupying the whole first courtyard, trampling the camellias and getting manure all over the shiny cobblestones. All this amidst a whirlwind of dust, a pawing of horses, and the curses of superstitious men who were gesticulating against the evil eye. They had come to deliver the body of Uncle Marcos and all his possessions. A honey-voiced man, dressed in black, with a frock coat and a hat that was too big for him, was directing the tumult. He began a solemn speech explaining the circumstances of the case, but was brutally interrupted by Nevia, who threw herself on the dusty coffin that held the remains of her dearest brother. She was shouting for them to lift the cover so she could see him with her own two eyes. She had buried him once before, which explained why she had room for doubt whether this time his death was real. Her shouts brought the servants streaming from the house, as well as all her children, who came as fast as they could when they heard their uncle's name echoing amidst the cries of mourning. It had been 2 years since Clara had last seen her uncle Marcos, but she remembered him very well. He was the only perfectly clear image she retained from her whole childhood, and in order to describe him, she did not need to consult the daguerreotype in the drawing room that showed him dressed as an explorer, leaning on an old-fashioned double-barreled rifle, with his right foot on the neck of a Malaysian tiger, the same triumphant position in which she had seen the Virgin, standing between plaster clouds and pallid angels at the main altar, one foot on the vanquished devil. All Clara had to do to see her uncle was close her eyes, and there he was, weather-beaten and thin, with a pirate's mustache through which his strange, shark-like smile peered out at her. It seemed impossible that he could be inside that long black box that was lying in the middle of the courtyard. Each time Uncle Marcos had visited his sister Nivia's home, he had stayed for several months, to the immense joy of his nieces and nephews, particularly Clara, causing a storm in which the sharp lines of domestic order blurred. The house became a clutter of trunks, of animals in jars of formaldehyde, of Indian lances and sailors' bundles. In every part of the house, people kept tripping over his equipment, and all sorts of unfamiliar animals appeared that had traveled from remote lands only to meet their death beneath Nana's irate broom in the farthest corners of the house. Uncle Marcos's manners were those of a cannibal, as Severo put it. He spent the whole night making incomprehensible movements in the drawing room. Later, they turned out to be exercises designed to perfect the mind's control over the body and to improve digestion. He performed alchemy experiments in the kitchen, filling the house with fetid smoke and ruining pots and pans with solid substances that stuck to their bottoms and were impossible to remove. While the rest of the household tried to sleep, he dragged his suitcases up and down the halls, practiced making strange, high-pitched sounds on savage instruments, and taught Spanish to a parrot whose native language was an Amazonic dialect. During the day, he slept in a hammock that he had strung between two columns in the hall, wearing only a loincloth that put Severo in a terrible mood, but that Nivia forgave because Marcos had convinced her that it was the same costume in which Jesus of Nazareth had preached. Clara remembered perfectly, even though she had been only a tiny child, the first time her uncle Marcos came to the house after one of his voyages. He settled in as if he planned to stay forever. After a short time, bored with having to appear at ladies' gatherings where the mistress of the house played the piano, with playing cards, and with dodging all his relatives' pressures to pull himself together and take a job as a clerk in Severo del Valle's law practice, he bought a barrel organ and took to the streets with the hope of seducing his cousin Antonieta and entertaining the public in the bargain. The machine was just a rusty box with wheels, but he painted it with seafaring designs and gave it a fake ship's smokestack. It ended up looking like a coal stove. The organ played either a military march or a waltz, and in between turns of the handle, the parrot, who had managed to learn Spanish, although he had not lost his foreign accent, would draw a crowd with his piercing shrieks. He also plucked slips of paper from a box with his beak, by way of selling fortunes to the curious. The little pink, green, and blue papers were so clever that they always divulged the exact secret wishes of the customers. Besides fortunes, there were little balls of sawdust to amuse the children, and a special powder that was supposed to cure impotence, which Marcos sold under his breath to passers-by afflicted with that malady. The idea of the organ was a last desperate attempt to win the hand of cousin Antonieta after more conventional means of courting her had failed. Marcos thought no woman in her right mind could remain impassive before a barrel organ serenade. He stood beneath her window one evening and played his military march and his waltz just as she was taking tea with a group of female friends. Antonieta did not realize the music was meant for her until the parrot called her by her full name, at which point she appeared in the window. Her reaction was not what her suitor had hoped for. Her friends offered to spread the news to every salon in the city, and the next day, people thronged the downtown streets, hoping to see Severo del Valle's brother-in-law playing the organ and selling little sawdust balls with a moth-eaten parrot, for the sheer pleasure of proving that even in the best of families, there could be good reason for embarrassment. In the face of this stain to the family reputation, Marcos was forced to give up organ grinding and resort to less conspicuous ways of winning over his cousin Antonieta. But he did not renounce his goal. In any case, he did not succeed, because from one day to the next, the young lady married a diplomat who was 20 years her senior. He took her to live in a tropical country whose name no one could recall, except that it suggested negritude, bananas, and palm trees, where she managed to recover from the memory of that suitor who had ruined her 17th year with his military march and his waltz. Marcos sank into a deep depression that lasted 2 or 3 days, at the end of which he announced that he would never marry and that he was embarking on a trip around the world. He sold his organ to a blind man and left the parrot to Clara, but Nana secretly poisoned it with an overdose of cod liver oil because no one could stand its lusty glance, its fleas, and its harsh, tuneless hawking of paper fortunes, sawdust balls, and powders for impotence. That was Marco's longest trip. He returned with a shipment of enormous boxes that were piled in the far courtyard between the chicken coop and the woodshed until the winter was over. At the first signs of spring, he had them transferred to the parade grounds, a huge park where people would gather to watch the soldiers file by on Independence Day, with the goose step they had learned from the Prussians. When the crates were opened, they were found to contain loose bits of wood, metal, and painted cloth. Marcos spent 2 weeks assembling the contents according to an instruction manual written in English, which he was able to decipher thanks to his invincible imagination and a small dictionary. When the job was finished, it turned out to be a bird of prehistoric dimensions, with the face of a furious eagle, wings that moved, and a propeller on its back. It caused an uproar. The families of the oligarchy forgot all about the barrel organ, and Marcos became the star attraction of the season. People took Sunday outings to see the bird. Souvenir vendors and strolling photographers made a fortune. Nonetheless, the public's interest quickly waned. But then Marcos announced that as soon as the weather cleared, he planned to take off in his bird and cross the mountain range. The news spread, making this the most talked-about event of the year. The contraption lay with its stomach on terra firma, heavy and sluggish, and looking more like a wounded duck than one of those new-fangled airplanes they were starting to produce in the United States. There was nothing in its appearance to suggest that it could move, much less take flight across the snowy peaks. Journalists and the curious flocked to see it. Marco smiled his immutable smile before the avalanche of questions and posed for photographers without offering the least technical or scientific explanation of how he hoped to carry out his plan. People came from the provinces to see the sight. 40 years later, his great-nephew Nicolás, whom Marcos did not live to see, unearthed the desire to fly that had always existed in the men of his lineage. Nicolas was interested in doing it for commercial reasons, in a gigantic hot air sausage on which would be printed an advertisement for carbonated drinks. But when Marcos announced his plane trip, no one believed that his contraption could be put to any practical use. The appointed day dawned full of clouds, but so many people had turned out that Marcos did not want to disappoint them. He showed up punctually at the appointed spot and did not once look up at the sky, which was growing darker and darker with thick gray clouds. The astonished crowd filled all the nearby streets, perching on rooftops and the balconies of the nearest houses and squeezing into the park. No political gathering managed to attract so many people until half a century later, when the first Marxist candidate attempted, through strictly democratic channels, to become president. Clara would remember this holiday as long as she lived. People dressed in their spring best, thereby getting a step ahead of the official opening of the season. The men in white linen suits and the ladies in the Italian straw hats that were all the rage that year. Groups of elementary school children paraded with their teachers, clutching flowers for the hero. Marcos accepted their bouquets and joked that they might as well hold on to them and wait for him to crash so that they could take them directly to his funeral. The bishop himself, accompanied by two incense bearers, appeared to bless the bird without having been asked, and the police band played happy, unpretentious music that pleased everyone. The police, on horseback and carrying lances, had trouble keeping the crowds far enough away from the center of the park, where Marcos waited dressed in mechanic's overalls, with huge racer's goggles and an explorer's helmet. He was also equipped with a compass, a telescope, and several strange maps that he had traced himself based on various theories of Leonardo da Vinci and on the polar knowledge of the Incas. Against all logic, on the second try, the bird lifted off without mishap and with a certain elegance, accompanied by the creaking of its skeleton and the roar of its motor. It rose, flapping its wings, and disappeared into the clouds, to a send-off of applause, whistlings, handkerchiefs, drum rolls, and the sprinkling of holy water. All that remained on earth were the comments of the amazed crowd below and a multitude of experts who attempted to provide a reasonable explanation of the miracle. Clara continued to stare at the sky long after her uncle had become invisible. She thought she saw him 10 minutes later, but it was only a migrating sparrow. After 3 days, the initial euphoria that had accompanied the first airplane flight in the country died down, and no one gave the episode another thought, except for Clara, who continued to peer at the horizon. After a week, with no word from the flying uncle, people began to speculate that he had gone so high that he had disappeared into outer space, and the ignorant suggested he would reach the moon. With a mixture of sadness and relief, Severo decided that his brother-in-law and his machine must have fallen into some hidden crevice of the Cordillera, where they would never be found. Nivea wept disconsolately and lit candles to San Antonio, patron of lost objects. Severo opposed the idea of having masses said, because he did not believe in them as a way of getting into heaven, much less of returning to earth. And he maintained that masses and religious vows, like the selling of indulgences, images, and scapulars, were a dishonest business. Because of his attitude, Nivea and Nana had the children say the rosary behind their father's back for 9 days. Meanwhile, groups of volunteer explorers and mountain climbers tirelessly searched peaks and passes, combing every accessible stretch of land until they finally returned in triumph to hand the family the mortal remains of the deceased in a sealed black coffin. The intrepid traveler was laid to rest in a grandiose funeral. His death made him a hero, and his name was on the front page of all the papers for several days. The same multitude that had gathered to see him off the day he flew away in his bird paraded past his coffin. The entire family wept as befit the occasion, except for Clara, who continued to watch the sky with the patience of an astronomer. 1 week after he had been buried, Uncle Marcos, a bright smile playing behind his pirate's mustache, appeared in person in the doorway of Nivia and Severo del Valle's house. Thanks to the surreptitious prayers of the women and children, as he himself admitted, he was alive and well, and in full possession of his faculties, including his sense of humor. Despite the noble lineage of his aerial maps, the flight had been a failure. He had lost his airplane and had to return on foot, but he had not broken any bones, and his adventurous spirit was intact. This confirmed the family's eternal devotion to San Antonio, but was not taken as a warning by future generations who also tried to fly, although by different means. Legally, however, Marcos was a corpse. Severo del Valle was obliged to use all his legal ingenuity to bring his brother-in-law back to life and the full rights of citizenship. When the coffin was pried open in the presence of the appropriate authorities, it was found to contain a bag of sand. This discovery ruined the reputation, up till then untarnished, of the volunteer explorers and mountain climbers, who from that day on were considered little better than a pack of bandits. Marco's heroic resurrection made everyone forget about his barrel organ phase. Once again, he was a sought-after guest in all the city's salons and, at least for a while, his name was cleared. Marco stayed in his sister's house for several months. One night, he left without saying goodbye, leaving behind his trunks, his books, his weapons, his boots, and all his belongings. Severo and even Nivia herself breathed a sigh of relief. His visit had gone on too long. But Clara was so upset that she spent a week walking in her sleep and sucking her thumb. The little girl, who was only 7 at the time, had learned to read from her uncle's storybooks and had been closer to him than any other member of the family because of her prophesying powers. Marcos maintained that his niece's gift could be a source of income and a good opportunity for him to cultivate his own clairvoyance. He believed that all human beings possessed this ability, particularly his own family, and that if it did not function well, it was simply due to a lack of training. He bought a crystal ball in the Persian bazaar, insisting that it had magic powers and was from the east, although it was later found to be part of a buoy from a fishing boat, set it down on a background of black velvet, and announced that he could tell people's fortunes, cure the evil eye, and improve the quality of dreams, all for the modest sum of 5 centavos. His first customers were the maids from around the neighborhood. One of them had been accused of stealing because her employer had misplaced a valuable ring. The crystal ball revealed the exact location of the object in question. It had rolled beneath a wardrobe. The next day, there was a line outside the front door of the house. There were coachmen, storekeepers, and milkmen. Later, a few municipal employees and distinguished ladies made a discreet appearance, slinking along the side walls of the house to keep from being recognized. The customers were received by Nana, who ushered them into the waiting room and collected their fees. This task kept her busy throughout the day and demanded so much of her time that the family began to complain that all there ever was for dinner was old string beans and jellied quince. Marcos decorated the carriage house with some frayed curtains that had once belonged in the drawing room, but that neglect and age had turned to dusty rags. There, he and Clara received the customers. The two divines wore tunics, the color of the men of light, as Marcos called the color yellow. Nana had dyed them with saffron powder, boiling them in pots usually reserved for rice and pasta. In addition to his tunic, Marcos wore a turban around his head and an Egyptian amulet around his neck. He had grown a beard and let his hair grow long, and he was thinner than ever before. Marcos and Clara were utterly convincing, especially because the child had no need to look into the crystal ball to guess what her clients wanted to hear. She would whisper in her Uncle Marcos's ear, and he, in turn, would transmit the message to the client, along with any improvisations of his own that he thought pertinent. Thus, their fame spread, because all those who arrived sad and bedraggled at the consulting room left filled with hope. Unrequited lovers were told how to win over indifferent hearts, and the poor left with foolproof tips on how to place their money at the dog track. Business grew so prosperous that the waiting room was always packed with people, and Nana began to suffer dizzy spells from being on her feet so many hours a day. This time, Severo had no need to intervene to put a stop to his brother-in-law's venture, for both Marcos and Clara, realizing that their unerring guesses could alter the fate of their clients, who always followed their advice to the letter, became frightened and decided that this was a job for swindlers. They abandoned their carriage house oracle and split the profits, even though the only one who had cared about the material side of things had been Nana. Of all the Del Valle children, Clara was the one with the greatest interest in and stamina for her uncle's stories. She could repeat each and every one of them. She knew by heart words from several dialects of the Indians, was acquainted with their customs, and could describe the exact way in which they pierced their lips and earlobes with wooden shafts, their initiation rites, the names of the most poisonous snakes, and the appropriate antidotes for each. Her uncle was so eloquent that the child could feel in her own skin the burning sting of snake bites, see reptiles slide across the carpet between the legs of the jacaranda room divider, and hear the shrieks of macaws behind the drawing room drapes. She did not hesitate as she recalled Lope de Aguirre's search for El Dorado, or the unpronounceable names of the flora and fauna her extraordinary uncle had seen. She knew about the llamas who take salt tea with yak lard, and she could give detailed descriptions of the opulent women of Tahiti, the rice fields of China, or the white prairies of the north, where the eternal ice kills animals and men who lose their way, turning them to stone in seconds. Marcos had various travel journals in which he recorded his excursions and impressions, as well as a collection of maps and books of stories and fairy tales that he kept in the trunks he stored in the junk room at the far end of the third courtyard. From there, they were hauled out to inhabit the dreams of his descendants, until they were mistakenly burned half a century later on an infamous pyre. Now Marcos had returned from his last journey in a coffin. He had died of a mysterious African plague that had turned him as yellow and wrinkled as a piece of parchment. When he realized he was ill, he set out for home with the hope that his sister's ministrations and Dr. Cuevas's knowledge would restore his health and youth, but he was unable to withstand the 60 days on ship and died at the latitude of Guayaquil, ravaged by fever and hallucinating about musky women and hidden treasure. The captain of the ship, an Englishman by the name of Longfellow, was about to throw him overboard wrapped in a flag, but Marcos, despite his savage appearance and his delirium, had made so many friends on board and seduced so many women that the passengers prevented him from doing so, and Longfellow was obliged to store the body side by side with the vegetables of the Chinese cook, to preserve it from the heat and mosquitoes of the tropics, until the ship's carpenter had time to improvise a coffin. At El Callao, they obtained a more appropriate container, and several days later the captain, furious at all the troubles this passenger had caused the shipping company and himself personally, unloaded him without a backward glance, surprised that not a soul was there to receive the body or cover the expenses he had incurred. Later, he learned that the post office in these latitudes was not as reliable as that of far-off England, and that all his telegrams had vaporized en route. Fortunately for Longfellow, a customs lawyer who was a friend of the Del Valle family appeared and offered to take charge, placing Marcos and all his paraphernalia in a freight car, which he shipped to the capital to the only known address of the deceased, his sister's house. This would have been one of the most painful moments in Clara's life if Barrabás had not arrived among her uncle's things. Unaware of the commotion in the courtyard, she was led by instinct directly to the corner where the cage had been set down. In it was Barrabás, or rather, a pile of bones covered with a skin of indefinite color that was full of infected patches, with one eye sealed shut and the other crusted over, rigid as a corpse in his own excrement. Despite his appearance, the child had no trouble in identifying him. "A puppy!" she cried. The animal became her responsibility. She removed it from the cage, rocked it in her arms, and with a missionary's care managed to get water down its parched, swollen throat. No one had bothered to feed him since Captain Longfellow, who, like most Englishmen, was kinder to animals than to people, had dropped him on the pier along with all the other baggage. While the dog had been on board with his dying master, the captain had fed him with his own hand and taken him up on deck, lavishing on him every attention that he had denied Marcos. But once on land, he was treated as part of the baggage. Without any competition for the job, Clara became the creature's mother, and she soon revived him. A few days later, after the storm of the corpse's arrival had died down and Uncle Marcos had been laid to rest, Severo noticed the hairy animal his daughter was holding in her arms. "What's that?" he asked. "Barrabás," Clara replied. "Give him to the gardener so he can get rid of him. He might be contagious," Severo ordered. But Clara had adopted him. "He's mine, Papa. If you take him away, I'll stop breathing, and I promise you I'll die." The dog remained in the house. Soon afterward, he was running everywhere, devouring drape fringes, oriental rugs, and all the table legs. He rapidly recovered from his terrible condition and began to grow. After he had had a bath, he was found to be black, with a square head, long legs, and short hair. Nana suggested cutting off his tail to make him more refined, but Clara had a tantrum that degenerated into an asthma attack, and no one ever mentioned it again. Barrabás kept his tail, which in time grew to be as long as a golf club, and developed a life all its own that led to lamps and china being swept from tabletops. He was of unknown pedigree. He had nothing in common with the stray dogs in the street, much less with the thoroughbred racers that assorted families of the aristocracy were raising. The veterinarian was unable to pinpoint his origin, and Clara decided that he was from China, because most of her uncle's baggage was from that distant land. The dog had a seemingly unlimited capacity for growth. Within 6 months, he was the size of a sheep, and at the end of the year, he was as big as a colt. In desperation, the family began to question whether he would ever stop growing, and whether he really was a dog. They suggested that he might be some exotic animal their uncle had caught in some remote corner of the world, and that perhaps, in his natural habitat, he was wild. Nivea looked at his crocodile claws and his sharp little teeth, and her heart leapt at the thought that if in one bite He could snap the head off any grown-up. It would be even easier for him to gobble up one of her children. But Barrabás gave no indication of ferocity. On the contrary, he had all the captivating ways of a frolicsome kitten. He slept by Clara's side, with his head on her feather pillow and a quilt up to his neck, because he was very sensitive to cold. And later, when he was too big for the bed, he lay on the floor beside her, his horse's hoof resting on the child's hand. He never barked or growled. He was as black and silent as a panther, liked ham and every known type of marmalade, and whenever there was company and the family forgot to lock him up, he would steal into the dining room and slink around the table, removing with the greatest delicacy all his favorite dishes, and of course, none of the diners dared to interfere. Despite his docility, Barrabás inspired terror. Delivery men fled precipitously when he stuck his head out into the street, and once he caused a riot among the women who were lined up waiting to buy milk, startling the dray horse who took off like a shot, scattering milk pails every which way on the pavement. Severo had to pay for all the damage and ordered the dog tied up in the courtyard. But Clara had another fit, and the decision was indefinitely postponed. Popular imagination and ignorance with respect to his past lent Barrabás the most mythological characteristics. It was said that he would not stop growing, and that if a butcher's cruelty had not put an end to his existence, he would have reached the size of a camel. Some people believed him to be a cross between a dog and a mare, and expected him to sprout wings and horns and acquire the sulfuric breath of a dragon, like the beasts Rosa was embroidering on her endless tablecloth. Tired of picking up broken china and hearing rumors of how he turned into a wolf when there was a full moon, Nana applied the same method she had used with the parrot. But the overdose of cod liver oil did not kill the dog. It simply gave him a 4-day case of diarrhea that covered the house from top to bottom and that she herself had to clean.
Those were difficult times. I was about 25 then, but I felt as if I had only a little life left ahead of me to build my future and attain the position that I wanted. I worked like a beast, and the few times I sat down to rest, not by choice, but forced by the tedium of Sunday afternoons, I felt as if I were losing precious moments of my life. Each idle minute meant another century away from Rosa. I lived in the mine, in a wooden shack with a zinc roof that I built myself with the help of a few peons. It was just one square room, in which I had arranged all my belongings, with a crude window in each wall so that by day the stifling desert air would have a chance to circulate, and with shutters to keep out the glacial wind that blew at night. My furniture consisted of a chair, a cot, a rough table, a typewriter, and a heavy safe I had hauled across the desert on a mule, in which I kept the miner's logbooks, a few papers, and a canvas pouch containing the few sparkling pieces of gold that were the only fruit of all my effort. It wasn't very pleasant, but I was used to discomfort. I had never taken a hot bath, and my childhood memories were of cold, of loneliness, and of a perpetually empty stomach. There I ate, slept, and wrote for 2 long years, with no greater distraction than the handful of books I read and reread, a stack of old magazines, some English grammars from which I pieced together the rudiments of that magnificent language, and a box with a key in which I kept my correspondence with Rosa. I had got into the habit of typing all my letters to her, keeping a copy for myself that I filed along with the few letters I received from her. I ate the same food that was cooked for all the miners, and I had forbidden the drinking of alcoholic beverages within the mine. I kept none in my own house either, because I've always held that loneliness and boredom can lead a man to drink. It may have been the memory of my father, open-collared, his tie loosened and stained, his eyes clouded and his breath heavy, glass in hand, that made me a teetotaler. Besides, I don't hold my liquor well. I get drunk in nothing flat. I discover